we are seeing the significant growth of evangelicalism within the UK. Certainly worldwide, the gospel continues to thrive and to grow. We mustn't lose sight of that much bigger perspective. I would say within FIEC, in this last couple of years, we've heard more reports of church growth, of conversions. We've heard at the Leaders Conference loads of stories of churches that are seeing people come to them, being converted, people turning up at church without anything the church has done, just people saying, I had to come to church.
Hello and welcome to Independence, the FIEC podcast for leaders. Great that you can come and join us. And John Stevens, the National Director, is here with me. Hello, John.
Hi, Adrian.
My name's Adrian Reynolds, and we're here to chat. Grab a cup of coffee and come and sit down with us. This is a kind of a chat on the sofa. We're thinking about global trends. We're looking back over 2024. We're trying just to stand back and say, you know, what's happening in the world and how does that impact us as church leaders? It feels to me, John, a bit like one of those highbrow supplements you get with the Sunday papers, you know, global trends. But it's good for leaders just to stand back and survey the scene, isn't it?
It is. It's good. I'm not sure we're quite as glossy as some of those kind of magazines.
There are glamorous
photos.
Probably
we aim to be mid-brow where we're kind of aiming for.
I always think you and I, John, are better in audio than we are in visual
well,
as well.
Absolutely. Yeah. But no, it's good to be able to kind of try to, in a sense, discern what's happened, reflect on it, what lessons there might be for the future, what we need to be watching out for. I think that's actually part of kind of leadership and Christian leadership.
Why is it part of leadership? Isn't that just a kind of, you know, nice to have for people who are interested in politics and, you know, geopolitics and world events? What is the biblical injunction to leaders to be thinking about these things?
Well, I think we have to understand our context, because if we're going to bring the gospel to bear, we need to be able to bring the gospel to bear in a way that's appropriate to the issues of today. And I think that's actually both positively. We need to think, how does the gospel connect with what's happening, what people are thinking, what are the issues they're facing and addressing? And there's also actually a negative side of that, of not distorting the gospel by over addressing the gospel to things that are happening in the culture. And I think Christians are in danger of doing both of those things. There's a danger that we kind of, in a sense, live in the past. We read what Christians in the past said at particular times, and those things might have been appropriate and said in the right way for the context at the moment. But you can't just simply translate that today. We can't just read out sermons from the Victorian period or the Puritan period and expect them to connect. I do remember a review of a collection of Puritan papers in which somebody said that this is a great collection of papers that will prepare you for every problem that the 17th century can throw at you. And at one level, that's right. We have to try to work out, you know, how does the unchanged gospel speak into our particular moment.
So let's have a little think about some of the trends that are happening. I've got four things to think about. And the first, I think, that I observe around the world is the rise of populism, which we've seen in at the beginning of 2024. It was said this is a big year for elections, and there have been some massive elections almost forgotten now. Elections in India, for example. Obviously the election in the US is fresh in our minds, but I think that the trend that we observe is this rise of populism, isn't it? I was in Romania last weekend, and they're in the middle of a presidential election, although their constitution doesn't really know what to do next, so they're in this sort of hiatus, because they were surprised that in the first round a pro-Putin leader who's very sympathetic towards the old Soviet Union won the most votes. And there is this sweep, isn't there? What's going on there, John?
Well, I think it might be better to think in terms of the triumph of populism rather than the rise. I think populism generally has been rising for some years. What's happened this year is that populism has led to changing of the political landscape.
What do you mean by populism?
Well, I think that's a really massive question, and people don't quite know, and it's difficult to define.
It's easy to say that the rise of populism.
I think what we're seeing is the collapse of centrist politics, people becoming more attracted to sort of more opposing views on the right and on the left. I think it's a kind of a rejection of what you might call the liberal, progressive, internationalist, globalist model, which has largely been dominant after the Cold War. Lots of populations feel that that has not delivered for them. It's not delivered for them economically. It's not delivered for them culturally, in terms of the changes that they've endured, particularly as a result of mass migration. I think it amounts to a desire for a greater sense of national and local identity.
So it's very connected with nationalism.
I think it is. Yeah. And who am I? Yeah. I mean, identity has been a big issue that's been being addressed. And one of the liberal progressive ways of dealing with issues of identity is to try to, in a sense, almost downplay the identities that people have and to highlight new identities, LGBTQ identities, gender identities.
Well, even in politics, I mean, you saw that across Europe. I think, I think over the 70s and the 80s and the 90s, a real effort for mainland Europe people to identify themselves as European. That all went with the EU experiment that was going on. But now you hear French people describing themselves as French again, and German people describing. Is that what you're talking about?
I think
about,
that's right. And I think actually what's been highlighted, liberal progressivism has tended to emphasize minority identities and give them a special privileged status, and has downplayed the identities that people have held historically and for a long period of time. And what people are doing is they're reasserting those identities as sort of significant, and they have felt threatened and displaced. So I think that's happened in a whole variety of different political contexts. Mm. We see it with the election of Trump in America. That's obviously contributed significantly to that. See it in France in the greater polarization between the left and the right, as you say. See it in various contexts in Eastern Europe. But it's not just that populism has won in various places, but actually the nature of the political debate has been changing. So even in the European Union, attitudes towards immigration have fast changed in Poland. So a greater emphasis on the nation state and the culture of the nation state. So I think that's been a significant shift that's been developing and has come to before. Perhaps one of the challenges with populism is that it also taps into the desire that there are simplistic ways of solving some of these problems. So leaders can set out an agenda and say, if only you give us power, we'll be able to deal with these things that nobody else has properly dealt with. And of course, the real challenge will be whether or not these leaders are actually able
That's
to
quite
address,
an easy thing to say when you're when you're a minority party and you're not likely to ever get power. So when you're really on the peripheral, so I'm sort of thinking about, you know, reform in the UK, you can make lots of noise about these things and make them sound very simplistic. But actually, when you're in government, as both the Conservative government found in the UK and actually now the Labour government are finding, these things are hugely more complex, aren't they?
Well, absolutely. So immigration is a case in point. So everybody feels that the immigration has been higher than they would want. The social consequences of that are concerning to many, many people. But you can use slogans, stop the boat. That's only about 3% of illegal immigration in any event. And quotas to stop people coming in. But it's not as simple as that.
No.
Because the whole problem with illegal migration is where do you deport people to? Who will take them back again? It's far more complex than you might think. It's not simply a question of kind of a European Convention on Human Rights and legal status. Actually, the very process of returning people to other countries is far more complicated.
And anyway, who is going to do all who are going to do all these jobs?
Well, absolutely.
There are.
So the population wants reduction in immigration, but it doesn't actually want to pay more for goods and services.
It doesn't want a reduction in nurses, for example.
So I think that is the dilemma. Populism taps into those issues by connecting with people's grievance. It doesn't necessarily provide a way in which that can be addressed. So I think one of the big things that in the next few years will be whether or not these populist agendas and leaders are actually capable of delivering what people want.
Yeah, and we're seeing that. I mean, what we're seeing around the world, we see in the UK as well, don't we? So even today in the news, the day that we're recording this, there's a question about whether there's going to be a new far left party. Mm-hmm. And actually, for the first time, we see people standing for election. Well, not for the first time, but in significant numbers, we see people at the far right and the far left being elected to parliament in the general election that we have this year, who are not part of the mainstream parties. So whereas before those positions would have been held within the mainstream parties, there's a right wing of the Conservative Party, there's a left wing of the Labour Party. Now suddenly we see the Jeremy Corbyns of this world on the left and, you know, the reforms of this world on the right, but basically forming separate parties. That's going to continue, isn't it, that trend?
It is, and you might say there's actually a bit of a change in the Anglosphere. Generally, political systems have had two major parties that have competed with each other, and coalitions. Both of those parties are actually coalitions of the right and the left. That seems to be breaking up into the creation of smaller parties, and in some ways that will drive more in the direction of Europe, Israel, other countries around the world where you have to negotiate coalitions between people.
Interestingly, I think, as I look around, those coalitions are harder to form. Mm. So it does seem to be that what's happening in France, what's happening in Germany, is actually that the various small parties are more representative of the various different positions than they are, let's say, than in the US or the UK. But actually, what were once stable coalitions, think of places like Germany, suddenly look as though they're inherently unstable. I think because people are People have much more confidence in their agenda, seems much less room for compromise.
Well, I think as people recover various kind of aspects of identity that have been downplayed, inevitably they want to express those. Yeah. And yes, you're right, it becomes then more difficult to be able to negotiate that. Actually, that to some extent is happening in evangelicalism, as people define identities more denominationally, more confessionally. People want to be uniquely themselves. That makes it slightly more difficult to build broader coalitions in which people recognize what they've got in common rather than perhaps what differentiates them from one another.
Store that one up, because we're going to come back to that. Just thinking about populism in general, how does that cash out in the church? You know, we're here to talk to church leaders. We're thinking about with church leaders ourselves. How does that work out in church? I guess there's an element in which people are aligned in different ways in church life. We've always got to navigate that. So as we think about migration, for example, it's quite a difficult topic, and that people in church will have very different views on that. So there's an element of which people's outside allegiances are shifting, and we've got to wrestle with that as leaders. But we see the same dynamics in church life, don't we, in terms of populism?
Oh, yeah, I think so. And you see that particularly in America, where things have become very divisive over the question of whether you support Trump or Biden, Republican or Democrat. That's often bound up with these sorts of issues. And the political agenda of the state has come to be very significant to churches and to Christian leaders. Mm. We see that a little bit less in the UK. I think the UK is slightly different. The majority of evangelical Christians in the UK tend to be slightly left of centre. At the moment. But there's no doubt that the growth of populism, those Christians who have a more right-wing perspective, a more cultural conservatism, feel potentially that populism is kind of the wind blowing in their direction. And there's a desire to get behind that and to sort of see the culture somehow being reclaimed as a result of that. You see that in the States, in the development of Christian nationalism as a whole different philosophy as to how a country should be governed, which is different to what you might call the kind of pluralism and multiculturalism that's been adopted up until now. And so there is that danger that a political agenda comes into the church and causes greater polarization between people, that they don't understand each other. There is a tendency to demonize one another for their views, to think that only one particular political perspective is the truly Christian political perspective. And it seems to me that the gospel actually critiques both positions, that there is something unique about the gospel, that it is neither in the end the populist conservative agenda, nor is it the liberal progressive agenda. It actually finds aspects in both that equate with the nature of the kingdom of God, but it actually finds aspects in both that it is deeply critical of.
That's helpful. Do you think as well, it just seems to me, reflecting on it and just what you were saying then, there are lessons there about the attitudes that this kind of movement has generated. A quickness to critique and to say what we don't like, a thought that there are simplistic solutions to really quite complex problems. So while I think that's true politically and geopolitically, I think that's true in church life as well. Mm-hmm. You know, I think evangelical Christians, especially conservative evangelical Christians, can often tend to be critical. I think that's one of our besetting sins as a movement. But actually, this amplifies that. You know, it's very easy now to say what I don't like. Mm. It's very easy to say what I would rather was different. And to think there are simplistic solutions. You know, if only we had that person preaching rather than this person. If only we had that leader rather than this leader. If only we had that structure rather than this structure. If we only had that building rather than this building, then everything would be okay. And actually, that kind of simplification of life, I think, just doesn't cash out. You know, we're dealing with leaders, aren't we, as difficult problems, multiple problems. You know, we've got a thing going on at church at the moment, and one person said, you know, very understandably, a church meeting can only think of one big thing at a time. You know, it's all I can cope with. But actually, as leaders, we're having to deal with complexity, aren't we, all the time? And if we embrace simplicity too much, we'll end up not being great leaders, I don't think.
Yeah, and I think you see that with the government, don't you? Labour was elected with a huge majority, with sort of an agenda in which there's things that they were going to pursue that would make life better for people. And actually, that has rubbed up against the reality of both the world.
Yes, it didn't take long, did it? It didn't take long.
But those problems were endemic. And actually both, all parties involved in the last election had a tendency to want to say that they could solve things rather simply if only they were given the opportunity without really acknowledging the depth of the problem. And actually people don't really want to face up to the depth of the problem. And I think actually there are deep problems in sort of Western culture. We've grown up with an assumption that we will simply get wealthier and wealthier, that we can achieve that whilst actually working less and less. And we've got a problem of an aging population that requires much more care for those that are sort of older and frailer. We've got a declining birth rate. I mean, there are a whole multitude of factors. Other parts of the world are rapidly developing and are therefore, in effect, exploiting markets that we might have thought we were dominant in before. All of those are very deeply rooted problems that cannot be solved sort of easily. And actually solving them almost invariably involves some significant cost.
Yes, so and time. And time.
Yeah. So we think about the moment they're discussing housing. Well, everybody knows there needs to be more housing to reduce costs to everybody.
Not near me.
But nobody wants it to be near them. Nobody wants it to be on Greenbelt near them. Yeah. So actually, we in theory want things to be done, but not actually if it has any personal impact on our own comfort. And I think that's actually the problem. As leaders, we have to recognize that the change that is needed is often costly and painful. Yeah. But very often, the people who want the change without the cost.
Yeah. John, let's talk a bit more briefly about some of these other topics that I want to cover. One is, I think, something that's become obvious to me, more obvious to me, it was already obvious, but more obvious to me over the last year, and I think it will continue on into 2025 and onwards, is just a very sobering reminder that we as evangelicals are small. I think we see that especially in the influence we have in our world, in our nation, the nation of the UK especially. We see that, I think, in the way that assisted dying has been put on the agenda and really Christian voices are marginalised. We see that, I think, in some of the talk about conversion therapy. You had a very bland letter back, didn't you, from 10 Downing Street in response to yours, which is basically saying none of your business. Well, it wasn't quite saying that, but it was basically saying we're going to do what we're going to do. And I think, I mean, whether there were ever any glory days, I mean, that's a different subject for a different moment. But I think we need to embrace our smallness, don't we, as leaders? We need to wrestle with what that means. In one sense, we're not small, are we? We've got an amazing God. and, you know, we pray to him and he's able to do all things. So in a sense, we are both massive, but also small. And we've got all those two things together, haven't we? Yeah.
Absolutely. And the statistics speak for themselves. So at a national level, the best statistics would suggest that the percentage of evangelicals is between 2-3% of the population.
And that's quite skewed anyway, isn't it? Because of diaspora churches and things that are going on in London.
Yep, about a quarter of evangelicals are now from an ethnic minority group, many of whom have migrated to the UK. So we are a very small percentage of the population as a whole from the start. Actually, the reality is evangelicals have always been a relatively small proportion of the overall population. But there's no doubt that for all sorts of historic reasons, a broadly Christian cultural perspective has shaped the nation over a long period of time. So even if evangelicals have been small, actually a Christian outlook in the broadest sense has probably been more dominant really up until the 1960s. But really from the 1960s onwards, that essential Christian cultural framework has been gradually being dismantled. Cultural church going, folk Christianity is in spectacular decline. The denominations in which that was most reflected are rapidly dying, churches are closing, people are not attending. So in no cultural sense is Christianity the framework with which people view life and view the world. So whereas we might have always been small, we could take it for granted that at least the culture more widely might pay lip service to certain key Christian principles and would
see some
broadly
value in them.
Christian morality as being good.
Yeah.
We now find ourselves a small minority and we do not have a culture that instinctively wishes to adopt a Christian.
So that's the thing that's changed. That's helpful, isn't it? Because actually, it's not necessarily our size as a relative part of the overall population. It's that the worldview in the majority view has shifted. which makes it more difficult for us to make a case for Christianity.
Absolutely. I mean, you have to say many of the cultural changes from the 60s, whether it be liberalisation of homosexuality, whether it be abortion, whether it be what is now potentially the introduction of assisted dying, all of those in the end have wide public support. And they reflect changed public opinion because they reflect the fact that the public culture has a very different ideological basis.
Do they have wide public support? I want to push on that a little bit because I think there's another thing going on here, which is that people are afraid of being bigots in different areas. So I just think of people I know who would privately, if you really could nail them down, say that they don't agree with things like liberalisation of laws on homosexuality and same-sex weddings, but would never say that in the street or in the public square because they're afraid of being labelled a bigot. Kind of the different categories, aren't there?
There may be a measure of truth in it. It's difficult to know exactly what everybody might think, but actually public surveys conducted across the population as a whole in which people can answer anonymously would tend to suggest that there are significant majorities of the population in favour of those things. The very fact that politicians pursue it and see political advantage in doing it, and it doesn't seem to have a vote cost to go with it, would also suggest that would be the case. And I think we tend to, what is a particular problem for us as evangelicals, we often live in our own bubble of either people who think identically to us, or we actually connect with people who in some ways share some of those same outlooks. And we kind of assume that that is what the population as a whole thinks. So I do think we are prone to think that our views are widely shared when actually we're not engaging with the wider population as a whole.
And that must be especially true for leaders because, you know, if evangelicals live in a bubble, leaders live in a micro bubble very often, don't they?
And online, we speak to ourselves. We speak to we listen to our own spokespeople who are interpreting it for us. We want to be encouraged to think that we are more significant than we are. And then we find ourselves constantly surprised that things go the opposite way from what we expect. And I think that is very often because we just simply haven't grasped the reality of how small we are.
I mostly agree with myself when I talk to myself. That seems to work well. The evangelical landscape is shifting as well, isn't it? So it's not just that we're small politically, if you like, in the nation, but actually within the UK, the evangelical landscape has taken a significant shift over the last 5 years, I guess. I think that's because of things that have been happening in the Church of England. We can reflect on that a little bit. I think it's because there's a wider shift worldwide that, as you intimated earlier, with the diaspora churches is also impacting the UK. So you've been to Lausanne and we've talked about that before. And actually there's clearly a shift in the leadership of the evangelical church worldwide, which again is reflected, I think, in the UK. And I think there has been a kind of retrenching behind certain sort of secondary positions. I think we feel that, don't we, in the FIC, if we're honest, but we see it more broadly, don't we? Actually, secondary issues seem to be more and more important. They seem to be defining. Is that all part of the same narrative in terms of people finding their identity?
Yeah, it's partly that. I mean, I do think we've perhaps presented a rather bleak picture of where we are culturally at the moment.
Yes, let's big it
I
up.
I do think the positive side of that is actually evangelicalism is growing.
Yes.
Yeah. And I think that's, I would say, we are seeing the significant growth of evangelicalism within the UK. Certainly worldwide, the gospel continues to thrive and to grow. We mustn't lose sight of that much bigger perspective. I would say within FIEC, in this last couple of years, we've heard more reports of church growth,
that's exactly right,
of conversions. We heard at the leaders' conference loads of stories of churches that are seeing people come to them, being converted, people turning up at church without anything the church has done, just people saying, I had to come to church. And I think that has been a significant trend. And in the UK, the face of evangelicalism is changing. The presence of a large number of people who've come to the UK who have migrated here, whether from Hong Kong, whether from Africa, whether from the Caribbean, whether from Asia.
Iran as well.
Iran, who are planting churches, starting churches, joining churches. So there is an evangelical growth at the same time, which we ought to rejoice in.
Absolutely.
And in a sense, I think that diversity of evangelicalism and growth enables people to slightly more want to emphasize their own identity. It's a combination of we might feel stronger and want to assert our identity, and also because we can see that evangelicalism is growing, but it's not necessarily with our kinds of evangelicals, then we want to be sort of slightly firmer in saying that these are the things that we think are evangelical. So one of the challenges is lots of people have different definitions of what they think evangelical means. It seems to me that broadly speaking, evangelicalism is a sort of a movement that's pan-denominational, that focuses on the core gospel truths, goes back to the 18th century revivals, statements of faith like the EA statement of faith, the UCCF statement of faith, the FIEC statement of faith, which kind of borrow from those, the missionary agency statements of faith. We're in a attempt to identify these are the core things that make a person evangelical, and we've built unity around those core things. I think there is, in what's going on at the moment, a desire on the part of people to re-emphasize the importance of other aspects. And what we might call secondary issues, they're not unimportant because they are significant to local church life, to practice, to doctrine. You can only really, in a sense, build and conduct a church with a clear view on a whole variety of other matters.
Yeah, of course. Yeah, you need to know what you are.
In the Christian life. Yeah. The danger is that that can drive into a sort of a more inward-looking tribalism. It seems to me you both have to have that clarity of who you are, but also that generosity to connect with other
evangelicals. Is unity as important as we say it is? Let's just explore that a little bit, because we look at places that try and create structural unity in a slightly artificial way, and we kind of, you know, analyze that and say, you know, that's not desirable and not good. That's not real unity. But what if every church just did its own thing? What's the problem with that?
Well, I think there's a difference between structural unity and relational unity and fellowship that recognizes we're brothers and sisters in Christ working together.
I do agree with you, by the way. I think slightly playing the devil's advocate.
Slightly depends on context. If you're talking about churches in, say, a massive city like London, there's scope and room for churches of all different flavors, styles, theological approaches, all of which can do their own thing and people can choose between them. The danger there is you end up actually competing with one another. Yeah. And it becomes like Premiership football teams in London, in which actually you want to support your own team and do down the others. And that's the way it works. At the same time, we've all got a vested interest in, to take the analogy, the promotion of football as a whole, as a grassroots game that we want people to come in. And it doesn't really matter whether in the end they support West Ham or Arsenal or whatever.
We still believe in the Football Association.
And so in that sense, we do have a common interest in wanting to promote faithful evangelical Christianity. So for example, we might want to support the church planting of other types of churches that will be reaching different people or in places where there isn't a church. Now, unity means doing that well, speaking well of one another and not seeing each other as primarily the opposition, but seeing each other as people basically playing on the same big team.
Yeah.
And of course, it's much more difficult in communities where there's a smaller population, where actually viably, you probably cannot sustain a multiplicity of churches. No. If you're going to establish gospel works in those places, essentially you have to draw together people from a variety of different backgrounds to be able to reach that particular community.
It seems to me what you're describing is that fellowship, which is what we are, is both harder yet more important.
Well, I would say exactly that. Yeah. I think it's more important in that only by recognizing one another and supporting one another can we begin to do the work of reaching the nation with the gospel. None of us, no grouping, no individual church will do that on their own. We need to see ourselves as having our own little place, which means to say that others are also doing that work, and we ought to be grateful and thankful for that work that they're doing. It's harder because if we are more emphasizing the things that make us distinct and unique, then by definition, we will be differentiating ourselves from others.
Yeah.
The challenge is, how do we differentiate ourselves from others without implying that others are thereby people who are significantly wrong and we shouldn't really be working with them and standing with them?
That brings us on to the fourth thing I want to talk about, which is our fellowship. We're not the only game in town. We know that, and we rejoice in all kinds of gospel work that's going on. But we do recognize that for independent evangelical churches, it's important to have a structure by which we can work together, we can serve together, we can pray together, we can do more together than we are apart. That's right at the heart of the fellowship, isn't it? And if, just to reflect, John, what we've got planned for 2025, we're not there to set an agenda. We believe in the local church, don't we? That's really important to us. And we are a fellowship of churches, though. Churches give money very generously to support the work centrally, which means we can employ staff to do things like this podcast, to do other things. So let's just reflect on what we've got planned coming up in 2025. More of the same, I think, is is basically the way to describe it, isn't it? We've discovered over the last year that we've been able to serve churches in God's goodness and providence. We've been able to do, I think, reasonably well. We're very grateful to God for his help. And we basically want to do more of the same, don't we?
Absolutely. I mean, back to what FIEC is, it's worth saying, I think we are a voluntary association. Yeah. So local independent churches choose to belong to FIEC. They don't have to. They actually have to renew their affiliation to FIEC on an annual basis. We don't control them. We don't dictate them.
We have no authority,
we're not telling them how they should do gospel ministry. We are united by our core convictions, identified in our sort of statement of faith and in our ethos statements. Within that, there's a wide diversity within FIEC. So at one level, we are navigating that challenge of being united in the core whilst expressing diversity.
Which is not without its challenge.
But we think that's historically, that is what FIEC has always been about. And we think that's vitally important to manifest that sort of unity in core things and standing for those. It's been exciting that that is a vision that has caused churches to want to come and join us in the course of this last year. So I think we've had something like 27, 28 churches that have joined FIEC in 2024, which is really encouraging. They get the vision. They want to be independent churches working together for the gospel. Lots of our ministries have grown. So I think really big things that we've been doing. We exist to help and support local churches. Our network of local directors is a key way of doing that. We've wanted to have people on the ground in regions, in local areas, supporting pastors, supporting churches, investing time in fostering relationships between them. Our plan is to try to expand that out over the next 3 years to make sure we've got coverage everywhere. But we've made a good start on that. And it's bearing tremendous fruit in terms of the local relationships that are being established. Our major conferences that we run on an annual basis have grown. So we had the largest ever Leaders Conference with about 1,100 or so people gathering in Blackpool from across our
churches. What's the plan? Can we just talk about what the plan is for 2025? Because it all the stuff we've been talking about, you might think actually this is the moment to look inwards, to get internal things right, to be thinking about how we maintain unity in the local church, but actually we're going big in 2025. We're going to be thinking about world mission. Because actually this is the precise moment to do that. Because as you reflect on the challenges there are in the local church, it's so easy to become introspective. It's so easy for our time to be occupied with just what's going on in our church or perhaps just locally around us. But I think we've got to think globally, that the gospel vision is a vision for the gospel all around the world. And we want to acknowledge that. We want to acknowledge that we've got much to give, but we also want to acknowledge we've got much to receive and much to learn. So the mission world has shifted. And I think a lot of churches are basically their global mission strategies are still stuck in the 1970s or even earlier. And so this is a chance to refresh, to rethink, to rejoice in what God is doing around the world. So I'm really, really, I mean, I don't need to be sold on world mission, but I'm really, really excited about 2025. And maybe you're listening and thinking, not so interested in that. Come along, because you should be.
I was already stopped by that, going to the Lausanne conference in September in Korea. I had a great opportunity to be able to do that and meet the worldwide church. I mean, it's clear that the leadership of the worldwide church has moved from Western countries to other parts of the world, and very intentionally on the part of the Lausanne movement for doing that. One of the striking notes from that was from the majority world church, the message to the church in the West: don't lose a focus on world mission. Yeah. We need you. We want to be part of that. And I do think there is a danger that actually the Western church can lose that world mission focus. It was very striking hearing from some churches around the world that are now gaining a mission perspective. So I hadn't realized that the Korean church is the second largest mission sending church in the entire world. But in the history of the Korean church, it's very striking that even when they were very small, right from the very early days, they had a commitment to sending out missionaries.
Yeah. And that actually built health in the church.
Indeed, the church benefits by having that much bigger vision, even if it's at significant cost to themselves. And I think there is a way in which we need to recapture that and think about how we serve world mission again in the UK. So we may be small, but we're not really necessarily thinking about sending people out into world mission in the way that was done in the past. And we must remember that world mission doesn't necessarily mean going to other parts of the world. No. The nature of the modern world is that, that we have people from a wide variety of different cultures and countries here in the UK. There's on the doorstep cross-cultural mission that needs to be done.
That old-fashioned distinction between home mission and world mission doesn't really work anymore, does it?
I think we've got to break down. Mission doesn't necessarily mean we can define that as sending people to other countries. And actually, it's not. It's sending people to the lost lost, and particularly sending people cross-culturally to people who are lost from a different culture.
We're slightly out of time, John, but we'll just put a link in the show notes to some of the other events that are going on. It's one of the key ways that we interact with leaders. Do look out for the local conferences. There'll be one near you. This year, looking at the theme of Proverbs and exploring what it means to be wise leaders. I think that's really wise shepherds. That's a really important theme. It'd be great to see you at one of the local conferences. And coming up sooner than that, we've got our Journeys Conference, which is our reimagined hub conference. And we do want to see a new generation of leaders. And we haven't really talked about this, but one of the other trends is just getting younger people to think about service and think about ministry. So that's a really important part of that. Planters, Thrive for Women in Ministry, Ministry Wives, all kinds of other things going on. Do take a look at the webpage. John, thanks so much. It's always stimulating talking to you. I'm sorry for being too bleak. That's exactly right. We had an elders meeting, didn't we, the other day, and it's so easy in leaders meetings to think about all the things that are not working. And we just said it's a discipline that we need to cultivate, to look at what the Lord is doing and to rejoice in that. So friends, wherever you are, do be rejoicing in all the Lord's helped you do in 2024 and anticipate with joy all that he'll be doing in 2025. Thanks, John. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks, Adrian.
We look forward to seeing you at something soon. If you've enjoyed the podcast, please do rate and review. It helps people find us. Catch up with you very soon.